Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? You're listening to Around the World with Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more on Around the World with Dan Perry.
I'm not sure whether I should feel terrified or morose or really happy. Jeremiah Jenny is my guest and he has just left my apartment. We had an awesome discussion. I'm really happy with how this podcast is going so far. I'm very much looking forward to keeping it going in the future. Thank you for listening. I really appreciate all of your support, all of your feedback. The morose and the terrified part comes from North Korea, which Jeremiah and I discussed at length during the show. He and I have both been there for different reasons, which you'll hear during our discussion. And things are escalating. I'm not even sure if Seoul is going to exist in the 10 days or so that are going to elapse between me recording this intro and actually putting the show out there. But hopefully everything is still fine by the time it hits the airwaves. Besides North Korea, Jeremiah runs a walking tour company called Beijing by Foot. Now, he'd kind of prefer it not to be called a walking tour company, though. It's more of a chance for you to get to learn an important piece of Chinese history from right here in Beijing. My wife and I and her parents took one of these tours with Jeremiah at the Summer Palace a few weeks ago, and we learned all about the Empress Dowager Cixi, who lived there for something like 40 years of her life. It was a really, really interesting tour, and I had already been to the Summer Palace a couple of times before that, but I never knew even a tenth of the stuff that I learned that day. So I was really happy to have gone, and I could totally recommend it for anyone who is thinking about coming to Beijing, or even for people who live here and want to know a little bit more about the city that they call home. The tour company again is called Beijing by Foot, and I'm going to put up a link to that in the show notes for this podcast. Jeremiah also has a blog called Jottings from the Granite Studio, and this is more of a collection of all of his writing that he does for various publications here in China. I'll also put up a link to that. And finally, Jeremiah has a podcast called Barbarians at the Gate. I've listened to every episode from season one. It's been entertaining and informing. It's a great show, and Jeremiah is going to start putting out new episodes very shortly. So tune in for that. I'll also put up a link to that in the show notes. If you want to know where the show notes are, if you're not on the website already, it's 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number, 1000daysbetween.com. Please welcome my guest, Jeremiah Jenny. How did you get into Chinese history?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I was in college, I've always liked history. I've always been kind of a history person, never been into math, that kind of thing. So I was pretty sure when I got to college that I wanted to do something related to history. What ended up happening, I went to college in the 90s, and at that time in the United States, there was a popular documentary series by the filmmaker Ken Burns about the Civil War. And it seemed that everyone who had liked history of my generation had seen this and internalized it. So when I got to college, like the first freshman history department mixer thing was like 82 dudes with goatees all talking about the Appomattox courthouse. And it occurred to me that the American history classes might be slightly oversubscribed. So instead, I started taking courses in a kind of wide variety of other historical fields, including European history, history of Africa, Latin America. And it turned out that the courses that were offered on Asian history had some things going for them. They were smaller they tended to scare off a lot of people. We had a couple of very good professors at my school as well, particularly in Chinese history, that kind of helped to kind of, you wanted to go to those classes. And over time, you know, just kind of fell into it. My third year in school, I did a study abroad in Singapore, National University, looking at the Chinese diaspora in Southeast Asia. And after graduating from college, you know, after working for a while, doing a little bit more school, landed back in Beijing, and landed in Beijing, I should say. Intent on working on some projects, doing some research, and doing some Chinese language training. And then I got a teaching job here for an American study abroad program that brings undergraduates from U.S. colleges and universities to Beijing for learning Chinese language and about China. Actually, it was the same program I'd gone to Singapore with when I was an undergraduate myself. And I've taught for them for many, many, many years. And then, you know, just like in Beijing, plans evolve, jobs change, roles expand. And I've been working much more in educational programs. So this is shorter term programs, people coming over, and working, you know, not just with students on a traditional semester basis, but working with students who are here for 1 or 2 or 3 weeks. And then over the last couple of years, I've developed a small business, leading educational programs and historic walks here in the city. That's taken off quite a bit.
Yeah, Katie and I went on one with you a couple, 3 weeks ago maybe?
That's right, the Summer Palace. That was a good time.
It was fantastic. I mean, I've been there a bunch of times to the Summer Palace, and I kind of knew the very high-level stuff of what it was. But you just taught us so much about Cixi and like her life there and her reign. And I really, I guess what I really appreciate with history is when I'm in the place and you can just say, yeah, this was the ship that she had built and here's why I got criticism and here's why maybe it was a good idea. And you just put it together really well, like stopping at different locations and going over a story. I think you're a really good storyteller too.
A lot of that, I think, I've benefited from having, you know, experience teaching. The walks began because one of the things I like about teaching history in Beijing is just as you said. I mean, if we're going to have class about the Empress Dowager, it's the Xi who, you know, ruled, you know, the Qing Empire de facto from 1861 to 1908. We could do that in a classroom with me with like a PowerPoint and a lecture, but we're in Beijing.
Yeah.
Let's just take this show on the road. And what ended up happening over the years, I did a lot of my classes on, you know, off-site at these different locations. And people would, my friends would ask me, you know, oh, that sounds, you know, like, what are you doing? I'm like at a class on the Empress Dowager at the Summer Palace or the destruction of the old Summer Palace at the old Summer Palace. And the people would ask, they thought it sounded interesting. People asked if they could come along, which I thought would be a little bit weird in the context of a class. So that's where I kind of started offering the kind of a version of the classes that I taught in some ways for the general public. And the storytelling, you know, I hear that and I hope my students don't take offense, but I mean, part of that is you have to find a way to make history interesting to undergraduates who may or may not have been, you know, at Lush and Wudalco the night before. And sometimes that takes a certain, you need to have a certain kind of dramatic approach to some of these things to hold attentions. And I get that, I was a student once too. I have to say that the students I teach here are much easier because of course they want to be in Beijing. This is a group of students, this semester I have 15 students. They could have gone anywhere for their junior year. They could have gone to Barcelona, you know, or Brisbane. They chose Beijing in January. And yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, that says a lot about them.
Yeah.
I mean, but even let alone students, even like me as an adult, I really like learning history when I'm there, but like history, like I'm reading about the Opium War now, a really long book, and I'm sure it's a great book, but it takes me a long time to get through it. You know, it's a slog for me. And a lot of it, I think, is just because I'm in my bedroom and I'm just reading some of it's pretty dry, the material. It's not like when I read fiction, I could just get through a whole book in a day or two because it's just so snappy, just dialogue and like the descriptions. But with a history book, It takes me a lot longer. A
couple of pipes of the East India's finest might help that along.
Yeah, maybe. Mood. Yeah, there you go. Well, for me, it might put me out, but...
Well, I appreciate that, what you're saying, and I think it's very kind of you to say that. I really enjoy leading the walks. I also really see them as an opportunity to have conversations about the places we go. I emphasize that I really don't see what I do as leading a tour or being a guide. I think in that context, you would be, you know, walking around and talking and people kind of passively listen, like, this is this building. I really appreciate it. I like it a lot more, and I really try, I hope, to facilitate a situation where, you know, we have a small group and people can ask a lot of questions and also, you know, bring their own experiences into it. Because you've been to the Summer Palace before. Many of the people who go on my walks are people who live in Beijing. They've been to these places before, whether they've gone by themselves or with another group or something. I really enjoy bringing, you know, their perspectives to the walk as well. Today I just led a walk in the Hutongs, and one of the people who was on the walk is a businessman who works in the Hutongs. And so, you know, along the way, he's adding his own commentary and his own ideas about what it means to, you know, rent a space and what this means, this new campaign in Beijing to brick up all the, you know, some of these illegal structures, quasi-legal structures, what that means for business owners. And that's great. You know, I welcome that because it benefits everyone involved when there's a conversation going back and forth rather than just one person, you know, speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're not bringing your ego into this, or at least as little as possible for a human being. But you kind of just glossed over this, but I think we should talk about this subject more, this bricking up of buildings, because it's been going on for a couple months now, I think, in Beijing. And I'll tell you what I've seen, then let you can comment on it. I live pretty close to a bunch of Hutongs, these old alleyways that lead through the old city that have been around for quite a while. And there's not a lot of, like, high-rise buildings in these areas. And one in particular, the third Hutong north of Dongzhimen, Nei Street here, on Santiao, was, one day I was just walking through, and there were all these restaurants along it, up and down the street. And they were just all torn to shreds, just the facades just knocked down from the walls, just bricks all over the road. And it was actually kind of hard even to get through the road. And then along there were the doorways of these places just had obviously very hastily built brick walls that blocked the entire doorway with large gaps between some of the bricks. And I don't know if they plan to redo them later.
They put a facade over them usually later. I've seen some of the phase two and phase three of these redevelopment projects, and what they do is they come over and they kind of put at least in the area I was looking at, and this is an area slightly to the northeast of the Forbidden City, they had bricked up about 3-4 weeks ago. I was there 2 weeks later, and they had smoothed over kind of a gray wall over where the bricks had been originally. But yeah, the idea here is, you know, this is part of a longer term process. Beijing is in the national government is in the process of reconfiguring Beijing as an urban space. They want to combine Beijing with its near neighbor Tianjin, which is just down the road, and the surrounding countryside into a massive urban metropolis, planned metropolis, called Jingjinji. So Beijing, Tianjin, and Ji, which is an old name for Hebei, the province that surrounds us.
Oh, that's what that means, okay.
And the idea is to create, a planned urban space of approximately 80 million people. So what's that, the population of Germany? And the idea is to spread the development out from the center of Beijing. And unofficially, Beijing, if you factor in all the undocumented workers from other parts of China, you're talking about 23 million people probably, unofficially. And they just don't feel it's sustainable to crowd, you know, most of that number inside the Fourth Ring Road. So the idea is to take the city of Beijing as we know it and make it a cultural, political, you know, center. That means there's a beautification campaign going on. And one of the things that the government has decided is an eyesore and it's not keeping with their plan for a modern Beijing are these temporary /ad hoc structures in the Hutongs. Now, these are created is you have, you know, a courtyard, or you have an interior space. This is usually zoned residential. But the one, the, these interior spaces, these residential spaces that have an external wall, a wall that is shared with the alleyway, many times what happens, the people will bust through that external wall, creating kind of a doorway or a window that then is rented out to retail or other shops or anything. For a long time in Beijing, this was the first stop for many economic migrant entrepreneurs. You know, it was the, if you were coming to Beijing with, you know, 30,000 kwai and a dream, this was where you would set up your first shop, your first restaurant. And you know, it still is that one of the things about this campaign to eliminate these spaces is the fact it tends to disproportionately affect migrant workers, economic migrants from other parts of China. But leaving that aside, you know, these are technically quasi-legal spaces. You know, the government is not totally in the wrong here to say we're busting holes in all of these external walls throughout the alleyways, and they're not necessarily legal, and in some cases they're not exactly safe. And so, and many of the businesses that are in them aren't, frankly, licensed. So the government, to some extent, may be within its rights to do this. The problem I think people have, and this is a problem generally in Beijing, is the somewhat haphazard enforcement of this. There seems to be, you know, again, why they're targeting certain neighborhoods, certain structures. In the end, you kind of see, okay, they're sort of semi-legal structures, fine, but why this alleyway, not that alleyway, and what's going to happen after they're finished bricking them up? Because it really is the most passive-aggressive urban development campaign ever. You know, it's like they threw out the original urban renewal playbook and replaced it with Edgar Allan Poe's Cask of Amontillado. You know, you can run your business just fine. Don't worry. We've got you. But we are going to build a giant brick wall right where your door and your window were. So if you want to run it, again, you know, behind the bricks, go ahead. We're not telling you can't run your business. But we're going to just, you know, no one's going to be able to see you. So yeah, it's just super passive aggressive.
Reminds me of last year when they had the big parade and the military parade. And one thing that they did was that got a lot of press was the monkeys, hired monkeys to shoo away birds. And I heard someone say like, the birds have the option if they want to stay or not. We're giving them the choice.
Exactly. If you want to tangle with a runaway, completely lost, invasive species, go ahead, Mr. Pigeon. You take him on.
Yeah.
But most of them probably were...
most of them got wise and chose to leave.
Not the first time Beijing has gone after the birds with poor results. The famous incident in the Great Leap Forward when they asked the farmers of North China to bang pots and pans to scare the sparrows into the air, and the sparrows died of exhaustion throughout the North China. Only later did somebody finally get the memo that sparrows don't eat grain, they eat the bugs that eat the grain. And one of the many flawed policies that led to that famine back in the 1950s. But coming back to the present day, I think too, one of the things that's getting, why this is getting some attention is that many of the businesses now that are being closed, because this has been going on sporadically for a couple of years and really started in earnest really, I think, last fall with Baochao Hutong, which is just east of the Drum Tower, just north of Namogusiang, got the bricks. And I think what's happening here is that many of the businesses being closed down are businesses that were popular with the international community. So in the last 24 hours, we've lost Tiki Bungalow, which won all kinds of awards as Bar of the Year in Beijing. They got 48 hours to move out. Their premises are going to be demolished. Moss Bar, which is a longstanding Hutong watering hole, not far away from where you were talking about, Beijing Santiao, they're closing down.
Moss is closing. Oh,
Rager Pie, another kind of local expat business, just sent out word that they're shutting down, at least for now. And then all over the city, you know, places, establishments that were popular in the international community are being targeted. Or not, I shouldn't say that. They're not being targeted because they're popular in the international community per se, but they're being caught up in this and people are noticing it now.
Well, it's a correlation, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's not like, you know, if it's the local green grocer, you know, the few people on that Hutong are going to notice that it's gone, right? But, something that's, you know, been written up in, you know, a travel magazine around the world gets closed down and everyone suddenly is like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
But I think that's one reason why we're talking so much about it as well.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm thinking there is like, or maybe was now, another bar right across the alley from Maz that catered to Chinese people. So I wonder if that one's still there or not.
I don't think they're targeting it. At least I haven't seen anything that would suggest they're targeting it based on like patronage. Yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with the structure. You know, a lot of people thought that they'd be safe because they had business licenses, but a business license plus possibly quasi-legal structure doesn't seem to work.
Sure.
And so it's a bit of a brush fire. Here's the part of it, though, that I'm concerned about, is that this seems like phase one, going after the low-hanging fruit. It's easy to kick people out of structures that, frankly, everyone agrees are probably a little sketchy anyway, or going after people without business licenses because, at the end of the day, you should be licensed to run a business. That's easy to do. I don't think they're done. And I wonder what phase two and phase three are going to look like. Are they going to go after more established businesses, more established neighborhoods? Are they going to go after residences? So we have all these nice restored duplex courtyard homes that people are moving into. Are we now going to be determined that the second floor or the renovations that were done for this are also illegal, and so now landlords have to... I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying... I hope people don't interpret that as saying that that's what's going to happen.
Right.
But there is something about this that strikes me as phase one.
Yeah, that's the scary part.
And so I don't know what phase two, phase three are going to look like, but I have a not-so-pleasant feeling that we're not going to like it.
Yeah, as far as phase one, I guess when I was just kind of describing it, or what you call phase one, what maybe phase one or maybe not, I first had some pretty negative feelings about it, but then I talked to a friend who actually used to live right by San Tiao, and he said, yeah, but think of it this way. There's these people whose families have lived there for 100 years, and these restaurants move in. They don't have a license. They build up this facade. They narrow the road so cars can't drive down it anymore. A car wants to drive down it. You have to pick up, if people are eating outside at a table, they have to pick up the table and move it aside and things like that. And on top of that, none of these places have bathrooms, so they're all using the Hutong toilet. And a lot of them people are getting drunk and, you know, vomiting or worse in the toilets. And all these residents, and a lot of the residents are old, and so they don't have bathrooms in their own homes either. So they get up in the morning and to go to this filthy toilet, and they probably don't appreciate the noise late into the night either. And I guess the point that he made was, in the Western world at least, we'd have that kind of thing would just never be allowed to happen in the first place. And here it seemed to be tolerated for a really long time until it wasn't.
I think there's some very valid points there. And I think, too, that one of the ways to look at this is, what kind of Beijing do we want? I think there's a lot of disagreement within the municipal government, the district governments, over what a modern Beijing should look like. I think that's one reason why we see kind of sometimes competing and often not always completely logical patterns of development through the city. I think we've got competing interests. But I think one way to look at it too is, you're going back to, what was it now, last week, the week before, and there was that small controversy with Dolce & Gabbana. And what had happened apparently was that they were doing a photo shoot in Beijing and using some of the old hutongs as the backdrop. And I'm sure from the photographer's perspective, you know, the idea of a fashion shoot in an old gateway or an old doorway or against one of these old brick walls made a lot of sense. But that it raised a small firestorm on Chinese social media because, and you sometimes see this if you're a photographer or you want to take groups around Beijing, what's the fascination with these hutong? You know, this doesn't represent Beijing. You should be taking pictures in front of the Intercontinental or in front of the NCPA. That this is this is the Beijing we want to see. And as it goes into, this is something I've talked about before, but the idea of authenticity, so many people from outside of China, you know, to some extent me included, we come to Beijing in search of old Peking and, you know, looking for the China that was, or that we thought was. a lot of people from Beijing and from China when they come here, and again, I'm making some sweeping generalizations, so yeah, but often want to see Beijing the way it should be.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying, I mean, what you're saying is a lot of residents, whether they live in the Hutong or they live somewhere else, you know, there's this attitude that, hey, you know, we're, is there a reason we need to keep our city, you know, old and somewhat chaotic because you find it colorful and it looks good on Instagram? And I think that's some, there's some definite tension there. I think there's some definite tension there as well. And so, you know, I understand, you know, the counterpoint to all of this, which is that, hey, you know, Beijing needs to modernize. Now, I think there's some real question of what that modernity looks like. But I'll tell you, you know, one of the things I hear a lot when I lead walks and I lead student programs and things like that, people say, you know, you go to some place like Sanlitun or even Nanluo Guxiang, which is that alleyway, which is either, you know, a thriving commercial and cultural district or the ninth level of commercialized hell, depending upon your perspective. But people walk down it in search of a authenticity. And the first thing you hear is the complaint, well, I don't like this. This could be anywhere. And yet, without realizing that somewhere in the city government, there's an official going, yes, that's what we're looking for. We want to be like everywhere. We don't want to be funky and weird and smelly and, you know, quaint. We want to be modern and express, you know, a vision of the future that will awe you with our, you know, the progress we've made. I'm not making fun because I think those are very valid things, but clearly they're also at odds with a vision of the city that incorporates a little bit of organic and sometimes messy street life and culture.
Yeah, it's such a dichotomy. It's something that I think all of us fall into as travelers, and it's not just China.
Oh, that's not key at all. Everywhere, I think that this authenticity question is a huge one, and there's been some good writings about it because, you know, we all search for the real Burma or the Myanmar, the real Siem
Reap. See, you even call it Burma.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a historian. I get into these jobs. But, you know, the idea is, like, we go searching for, like, the real Angkor Wat, and then we all follow our guidebooks to get the perfect sunrise picture.
Yep.
And that's that perfect shot. You know, it looks like you're standing there in front of the temple with the sun rising behind it, and then you turn that camera around, and there's 6,000 people standing behind you, yep, all trying to get the same damn shot. And we trample the grass, and we squash the culture in our attempts to find and capture the unique authenticity that we and we alone shall share with the world. And of course, we're destroying it as we do it. And I think that's a larger question for the travel industry. But in Beijing, I think it's also, it comes into conflict with a country and a city that's developed so fast and has very strong ideas about what they would like to present for the world. And, you know, I think too often that does not include old.
Yeah, they're very concerned about image here. One thing I've learned from living here.
And when you take pictures, I know you take a lot of pictures.
A lot of pictures.
And I was wondering if anyone's ever come up to you and said, why are you taking this picture, or given you any flack for a particular photo you were taking?
I don't think I've ever gotten that in China. Honestly, maybe on a very minor level, but I've never gotten, like, berated or anything, which is, you know, it's a little surprising maybe, but honestly, China, people don't seem to mind here people I've talked to. I mean, even if I talk, you know, take pictures of other people, I mean, I think a big part of it, or for me, like, if China versus other countries that I've visited, people come up to me all the time and take my picture. And so I really don't have a problem with taking a picture of them. And
it does give a certain freedom.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, well, it works both ways, guys.
I always wonder what they do with those pictures. If somewhere in Hebei province there's like a slideshow going on with, and this is grandma and the baby in Tiananmen Square, and this is grandma and the baby at Great Wall, and this is grandma and the baby on Wangfujing where we met a Wookiee, and he's standing in the middle there, moving on, you know.
Right, right. It's something like that. And Katie and I have actually had, like, contests about who can get more pictures. Or no, one of the rules, though, is we're not allowed to go, like, seek the pictures because that'd be too easy. But just who approaches, or which one of us gets approached more. because she is blonde and I am very tall and have long hair and a beard. These are things that you don't see in Chinese people. So depending on where we are, once we go to smaller cities in China, we just get constant attention. But I will say virtually all of it is positive, or at least not negative. It's really a friendly country to visit.
Oh, I agree. I think one of the things I like about China a lot is that compared to many countries in the world, and particularly several countries in its immediate neighborhood, people I meet in China tend to be very open and friendly on an individual basis. If you take a train ride, you know, of any distance, especially one of these overnight trains through the countryside, you'll be almost instantly adopted by a family. And within 2 hours, you're sitting on the bunk with like somebody's six-year-old teaching them English while the aunt is like giving you sunflower seeds and you're playing cards with the grandparents, even if you don't understand the game.
Absolutely. Like, some of my friends here have asked me about trains because I've done a lot of overnight trains. And I think I've even been in hard seats like 5 or 6 times, which that's a little brutal. I'd recommend doing it once just to see what it's like. But beyond that, I think hard bed or the hard sleeper class is the way to go. And people, the foreigners I meet tend to go, well, shouldn't I just get a soft sleeper? Isn't that better? Then there's only 4 beds in the room and I can shut the door. And I'm like, yeah, it's a little more comfortable, but you're not going to meet people. Not in the way that you would in the hard sleeper.
The difference, too, I think, is the soft sleepers, there's a wall. And if you're tall like we are,
yeah,
I need that extra 2 inches of legroom I get from being able to stick my feet out through the the base of the through the bunk.
Yeah.
And so if I don't, I can't lie straight on one of those bunks.
Yeah, I guess I haven't thought about that. But I do remember once I stuck my feet out like that, and the employee kept walking past and hitting my feet with his head. And I had to curl up on that one.
But, yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, this it makes China a very nice place to live and to study. I think also language and etiquette here isn't treated with the same level of seriousness that it is in some other countries. Everyone here is from somewhere else. China is such a huge, diverse place. There really isn't any one way of saying or doing anything. And so foreigners tend to do and say things in very strange ways, but it's just stranger than the way somebody else might say it.
Right.
It's not necessarily like an alien species has dropped into the midst. So I find that to be a very, very comforting thing, and perhaps one of the reasons why I've stayed here for so long.
Yeah, is your Chinese pretty good now?
Yeah, it has been. I mean, I studied 2 years intensively a long time ago, and lived here and worked here ever since. And I think there are people who are better than me. You know, I certainly am quite capable of in business and in office and in most situations. Mm-hmm. I think my biggest trouble has always been that when I first started studying Chinese, I was coming at it from the perspective of someone who was going to do research in history. So I spent a lot of time reading characters, learning classical Chinese, and reading texts, and not necessarily focusing as much as I should have on speaking. And so, you know, the tones and I have never been particularly good friends. Just recently, me and Fourth Tone, we started to exchange text messages. We're gonna get coffee later. We're trying to rebuild that relationship. Once I work on Fourth Tone, I'm gonna invite the other three over and see what we can work out.
Is Fourth Tone yelling at you now because you've been ignoring it?
Well, Fourth Tone just generally sounds like it's yelling anyway, so.
That's what I mean.
Fourth Tone was always the easiest one for me.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna start with that one and build a relationship from there.
I studied on my own for 2 years fairly intensely, like an hour, maybe 2 hours every day. And now the last year I've kind of backed off on that a lot. I've got other things going on. But it almost took me a couple of years to realize, man, I focus too much on the tones, like getting them all exactly right. And then when I'm actually talking, the cadence just sounds weird.
I will disagree with you there. I think that if you over study the tones and your cadence comes out a little bit weird, that will be better than what a lot of people do, raising hand, and just simply try to talk fast because it sounds native, but saying everything in the fourth tone, which is much harder for people to understand than if you talk very slowly or in a kind of somewhat stilted pattern, but every tone is exactly correct.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
And I'll tell you, I mean, this is something Chinese teachers debate right now. I'm coming down on the side that I think it's a mistake for Chinese language programs to teach how to write characters, especially in the first 2 years. I think the first 2 years, and this happened to me, you get bogged down learning how to write characters and do dictations, when what you should be doing those first 2 years is what you were doing, which is drilling tones until you can't forget them. Because once you get those habits, if you get bad habits in those first and second years as it relates to pronunciation and tones, you will spend the rest of your Chinese speaking career working to break those habits. Writing is important, but I think in this day and age, in terms of the skills, getting those tones, getting the pronunciation, getting that spoken, those speaking skills right from the beginning is critical. Writing can be integrated later on. I think character recognition and reading, that's important. Listening comprehension is important. But the habits you pick up in that first 2 years with speaking, those will be with you forever.
Yeah, like when I started, I was only doing audio. I took Pimsleur lessons.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it. That, I think, really helped me to understand how the language sounds and how it's spoken. It doesn't help at all with the characters. And I came here and I had studied for like a couple months before coming here. So I could actually say a few things, have a basic conversation from day one when I came to China, which is, I had a leg up, I think. It was like really helpful. But then I realized very quickly that I was completely illiterate. And I kind of didn't like that feeling. So I think that's where I got more into like studying the characters. It's especially happened with food. Just being able to read a menu is such a good skill to have.
I think, and it's sort of a cynical way too, character recognition is important because obviously you want to be literate, but if you want to ever actually send a message to somebody, just do what everyone, like no one in China writes characters anymore.
Oh,
as
yeah,
long
yeah.
As you can text it and you can read it.
Right.
That's why character recognition becomes so important, because at that point, if you can read and you can speak and you can listen, you can pretty much get by as most people do here in China. I don't remember the last time I've seen someone in China, you know, write extensively in Chinese using a pen and paper, just like I can't remember the last time I saw someone write extensively in English using a pen and paper for that.
That's matter. True. Yeah, I've even had like recently been out to a restaurant with somebody who is Chinese, and they had to write something and forgot how to write a couple of the characters like for the food they wanted. And it's super embarrassing when they're with a foreigner who's like, wait, you can't write your own language? But I totally understand it.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody's got phones now, and it's so easy just to punch in a couple of keys, and then the phone brings up the character. And
that's what I do. I can't remember the last time I had to write anything longer than one sentence in Chinese. I'm sure the last time I did it was probably some kind of confession at the police station when I didn't register with my alien registration form in time, or probably wrote like, you know, something along the lines of, I'm a very bad person, I will not violate the sanctity of the motherland again, or whatever the hell they wanted you to write.
Just so that you could stay in China.
Yeah.
All right, so moving on to other subjects, the thing that is obviously on everybody's mind right now is the escalating tensions in North Korea. And you and I have both been there. I went as a tourist about a year and a half ago. And you work for a company here?
I lead trips for a company that's based in Beijing that does tours to the DPRK, and a couple of times over the last year or so, I've gone there as a trip leader, and it's something I do, you know, periodically, hope to continue in the future. You know, business, international policy, allowing.
Yeah, so we're both pretty familiar with the place, and I'm sure you know a lot more than me, but I've become like really interested in it in the last couple of years, just how it's even able to be there in this modern world and still this, like, what do they call it, the hermit kingdom still existing, you know?
I think, and then maybe this is sort of by way of caveat, I mean, I hope the fact that I'm leading off with this doesn't make anyone think I'm doing any kind of apologies for the regime or anything like that, but I do think that some of the way that the media talks about Korea, like the hermit kingdom, or the constant use of the term crazy or insane. It may in large part be accurate, but it is, I think people should be aware that it's also recycling some pretty old tropes about how we talk about Asia. It recycles those old Asian despot tropes that, you know, were used to advance strategic interests in Asia at the expense of India, China, several other countries. But that said,
I appreciate that, by the way. You've got a lot of knowledge of history that I just don't have in my brain, and I think we should agree on that. Like, ad hominem attacks aren't doing anybody any good.
Yeah, but that's very true. But there are moments where it does seem like the leadership there is crazier than a shithouse rat, and it's hard to you want to balance the fairness in how you speak on the subject with it. Occasionally, the actions, the rhetoric that comes out of Pyongyang is certainly alarming. I think one of the misconceptions, though, is that they are crazy. I think when you start calling an opponent or a strategic rival crazy, you stop trying to understand their motivations and what they're hoping to accomplish, and that's a mistake. I think that perhaps it's even possible or even likely that the government in Pyongyang creates a certain sense of heightened chaos, basically making the world think that they're crazy, but does this in a quite calculated fashion in relatively regular intervals to ratchet up tension, to draw attention to Korea in order to get what they want, you know, whatever that may be, whether it's an easing of sanctions or some kind of deal. I mean, we see this over and over again over the last, over the last 60 years, but certainly over the last, 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like going back to the early 90s when, the Soviet Union collapsed, North Korea was in some serious financial difficulty, and, obviously that led to a famine. It seemed like back then, from my at least understanding of it, that that money was a big motivator. They could use an improved economy, and one way to get money out of the West was to ratchet up nuclear ambitions.
There are some scholars that I've read who argue that the deals that were made with North Korea at that time, and this was during in the U.S. this was during the Clinton administration, were fairly generous, but that was because the American negotiators just assumed they'd never have to live up to it because the regime was going to collapse within a matter of years anyway. So they were willing to give whatever the North Koreans wanted because it wasn't going to matter in the end. But then I think Korea surprised everybody by its resiliency in the face of that famine. Although, as you know, if you've been, those of us who have been there know this, the famine changed so much. It really reduced the ability of the state to control the economy and society to the extent they had, prior to the famine during the years of Kim Il-sung. The controls on movement of people around, that became very difficult to manage. The development and the evolution of gray markets, basically open air markets, the gray economy, because these were needed. It was the only way that goods, and food and other things were going to flow efficiently or even somewhat efficiently around.
Yeah, because prior to that, people got their food from government warehouses.
It was
right?
A government ration, and that system all but collapsed during the famine.
So you're not getting any food from the government anymore. Well, you got to get food somewhere.
Exactly, and coming out of the famine and into the first, the 2000s, there were a lot of things, and a lot of these controls had fallen by the wayside, or at least were severely weakened. I think what we're seeing a little bit in Korea today is an attempt by the government to try to reel it back in. You had the currency reform, I think it was 2009,
Yeah, you want to talk about that a little bit? Cause
well, from what I understand, it was a botched job. It was, you know, it's not unusual in situations where countries have a gray market for the government to do a currency switch that then all but wipes out any kind of gray or black market savings, because if it's in the bank, it's fine. If it's not, it's suddenly worthless or worth much less. So what they did, and I have to look this up, but it's something like they lopped basically two zeros off of the yuan. But in order to make people feel happier about this, they also told everyone that their new salaries, the salaries that they had, if they're getting paid 10,000 yuan before, they would still get paid 10,000 in the new yuan. Huh. Except the new yuan had already lopped off two zeros. So basically everyone, they not only did they reform the currency, but they simultaneously gave everyone, what, a 10,000% raise.
Sure.
So without realizing that the obvious effect of this was going to be massive inflation, and it all but undid the currency reform within a few months. So what we see here is this sort of systematic attempts to try to reel in the things that have escaped state control, but having done it in a way that suggests a limited understanding of how these things really work. So, you know, life remains obviously very hard in Korea. Those of us who travel there will not probably see much of that. You know, it's still one of those places where, like it or not, you're going to be shown what they want you to see. On the other hand, I listened to Rick Steves Travel. He was interviewing an American woman who had written a book about her experience behind, like in Pyongyang, behind the lines. This woman had basically signed up for a tour that's very similar to the ones you were on and the ones I read. She had somehow parlayed this into a book deal. And you know, the way she's talking about this, you know, I went down into the metro and suddenly all of the actors sprang into motion.
Right.
And
right.
I kept listening to this. I'm like, I totally understand the Potemkin quality of travel in a place like Korea. It's just like it was in the old days in China or in the Soviet Union. You're going to see what they want you to see. You're going to see the best face forward. But, you know, I'm sorry, honey. The cash-strapped North Korea is not paying 7,000 extras to pretend to be metro passengers just so they can impress, you know, some middle-class muffin from Midwest. You know, I don't see that happening. And so, you know, the narcissism of that is just staggering. And I maybe it's unfair to pick on this one particular author, but I hear that, I see that strain appearing in a lot of the writing I see about Korea.
Yeah.
And I have to sometimes take pains on the trips to also dial it back from some people who are convinced that what they're seeing is all a giant charade.
Huh. See, I went there thinking the opposite. And actually, I should point out that in addition to that type of rhetoric, like, oh, it's all fake, occasionally you'll see a story like photographer goes to North Korea and sneaks out all these photos, like illegal photos. And I look at the photos and they're like, they just went on a tour.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. They want you to take those photos. It's fine.
The week after I got back, I was just there recently to lead a trip for the Pyongyang Marathon. And I actually ran the 10K, which is kind of fun. You run through the streets of Pyongyang and high five passersby, that kind of thing. But the week after I got back, of course, Pyongyang opened, did an invited junket for many of the foreign correspondents from Beijing and from the Northeast Asia. So, you know, a lot of like LA Times, The Guardian, maybe it was The Guardian, LA Times was there. I know some of the other foreign correspondents in Beijing went as well. And, you know, some of the dispatches were very good. Some of them were, you know, an ode to that weird chicken patty sandwich they serve on the Koryo, Air Koryo, what experienced Korea travelers call the Koryo burger. Maybe it's chicken, maybe it's pork, who knows? But it was like there's like 500 words on the Koryo burger. I mean, it was cute, but it was kind of like, you know, it was cute, but we didn't go to North Korea and discover the secret stash of uranium. So, you know, some of the tweets that were coming out from the or posted after people came back were a little breathless. you know, exclusive coverage of Pyongyang, and you can see that they went to exactly the same places that almost every tour goes to.
Yeah, the itineraries are pretty much the same. I mean, there's maybe, actually, I should say there's probably twice as many sites that might happen, depending on the time of year, depending on like the festival that you might go to, that we actually went to in the 6 days we were there.
And some companies have quite extensive itineraries. The company I lead trips for, and if anyone's interested in that, you know, they can email me. I'll be happy to give you the information. It's a pretty good company.
Okay, I'll put your email and your websites up on my show notes.
That would be great. But the company I lead trips for, they do trips both group and private to just about every corner of the DPRK, from mountains to the sea, to extended trips in nature to cities. You know, they've been doing this for over 2 decades. They really have built up a fairly extensive knowledge of the country. So people who are interested in doing more of a deep dive, they do have that on offer. But the fact is that most people, when they go, they do kind of a variation of Pyongyang, you know, DMZ, yep, and then maybe one of the satellite cities,
Kaesong.
Exactly, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, it's, I firmly believe that travel to places like Korea brings important, you know, positive influence. And I know there are people who will say, you know, you're supporting the regime, whether it's through hard currency or just simply being there kind of normalizes, mm-hmm, what goes on there. But at the end of the day, it's hard. In any situation historically where there was a closed society, the more people who traveled there did not make it more closed. Yeah, a society that was closed has never, you know, has never been, it has always been influenced by, and people from other places travel there, even if it's under tight control. You can take a look at China in the early 1970s, early 1980s. There are other examples around the world, Cuba today. So I think that the benefits of having people travel there outweigh the potential costs of you know, the whatever people are thinking in terms of supporting a regime and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's not as simple as people tend to assume that it is, like when they first hear about tours going there. And I actually had a friend who was under the impression that I paid like $10,000 to take a tour there and that the government was charging all this money. I'm like, no, dude, it was like 1,200 euros and that included a flight and like 6 nights in a hotel and all of our food and everything. It's not that much money. That's the, you know, the maximum amount that could possibly be going to the regime is pretty small, you know, from one guy. And okay, you could even argue that even giving 1 cent to the regime is bad, but like you're saying, there's counterpoints, and it's a much more difficult equation.
You look at what happened during the Sunshine Policy years between South Korea and North Korea, which was, you know, a few years ago. But South Korea opened up these joint ventures, you know, tourist joint ventures, industrial joint ventures, and you know, ultimately they didn't work out for political and other reasons. But you know, there are some, you know, scholars who study the DPRK that, you know, write that the very presence of the South Koreans there, even if there was considerable effort on the part of the Pyongyang government to keep ordinary North Koreans away from the South Koreans in terms of interaction, just little things like looking through the fence and seeing that the South Koreans were a head taller.
Yeah, they can tell right away.
And were dressed better. And, you know, that was a while ago. And I think, you know, the openness, it causes people to kind of question some of the preconceived, you know, and it's still a very closed information environment, but having people there, it's not going to change overnight. Something like this is probably not going to have that much of an influence in the long run anyway, but it's little tiny, it's a little microscopic hairline fractures in a pretty monolithic information environment, and I think that's worth it.
Yeah, I fully agree. I don't think I had this gigantic positive impact, but you know, I got to imagine a few people saw that guy, really tall guy, carrying a really nice camera, and they're going, "Huh, I don't have a nice camera." But anyway, you refer to it like there's no way it's going to, that us visiting there is going to crack it right away. But there are some big tensions now that could escalate. So, what do you think is going to happen there?
You know, I mean, one of the strangest things was when I was in Pyongyang a couple weeks ago, these tensions were rising at that moment. And honestly, I didn't get a sense of that when I was there. It was only when I got back to Beijing. And nothing like a week in Pyongyang to make Beijing seem like a bastion of freedom and openness. You're the only people getting off the plane going, "Beijing, sweet freedom!" As your internet comes to such life as it is behind the firewall.
But, and you don't have to stay with a minder. I felt so freeing to come back here, for sure.
My goodness, we've been conditioned. But I didn't have any sense of that until I got back to Beijing. And then, you know, I posted a generic, "Hey, I'm out of North Korea. Here's my picture of me in the road race" on Facebook. Right. And like the next 10 minutes was just people like, "Oh, thank God. You know, what's it like there? It's got to be crazy inside." I'm like, hold on a second while I pull up the New York Times, because clearly I'm missing something.
Right.
But I do think there are a lot of tensions there. I think we have two narcissistic, unstable, and not terribly well-informed leaders facing off against each other, with Xi Jinping in the middle. And that's obviously Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. And, you know, doesn't make me as an American particularly happy to think that in this equation, I'm not sure who the less informed, more narcissistic, or crazier one is.
Or who has the worst hair.
That too. Speaking of the hair, I don't know if you know, in Korea now, almost every new picture or statue of Kim Il-sung is subtly being modified to look like Kim Jong-un.
Really?
I don't know if it's a stated policy, but I saw several newer statues and pictures of Kim Il-sung, and it is glaringly obvious that there's some kind of like modification here, because there's a big statue of Kim Il-sung in the Fatherland Victory Korean War Museum, and to a person, every one of the people on my trip goes, "Oh, that's Kim Jong-un." No, it's the grandfather.
Oh, I do remember though. I don't know about the statues specifically, but I do definitely remember traveling through the one museum that's below the big monument with the hammer and sickle and
The party.
That museum with a bunch of pictures of. Mm-hmm. Kim Il-sung, all the pictures in their giant blown up pictures of Kim Il-sung, and I kept looking at him going, "Damn, that looks just like Kim Jong-un," and I kept thinking, like, how did Kim Jong-il happen? Like, he looks nothing like them.
Mommy's got a secret?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, or skipped a generation? I don't get it.
God love you, made that joke in Pyongyang. but the idea is that you have these two relatively inexperienced leaders facing off against each other. And obviously everyone's worried about Korea developing nuclear weapons. You know, Seoul has always been in the line of fire. That's always been the concern, that even with conventional weapons, North Korea could put a world of hurt on Seoul.
And I think this is something the media, most media, totally ignores, that this has been a concern since the 1950s.
Absolutely. I think what's changed it is the ability of North Korea, or the possibility of the ability of North Korea to threaten Japan, the U.S., or further afield. And I think that's what everyone's concerned about. And it makes sense. You know, you don't want to live in an age of nuclear blackmail with a state that is prone to blackmail. But my biggest takeaway from all of this is everyone's wringing their hands and saying something must be done, and no administration ever does anything. That's true. What do you want them to do? There are no military options against the North Koreans unless somebody is hiding Iron Man in a vault somewhere.
Well, let's go over what would happen, because I think a lot of people just think, why don't we just bomb the shit out of North Korea? What if we did that, like launched an invasion?
Well, I think you got, there's basically three approaches to this. One is the surgical strike that takes out Kim Jong-un. We call that the send in James Franco strategy. The second one is the tactical targeting of the weapon systems in North Korea to knock out their ability to respond, or at least, you know, knock out their nuclear program with using air power and without putting boots on the ground. And the third option is, all right, let's just go in there and invade. the first one, the surgical strike against Kim Jong-un, even if it were successful, you know, certainly he's accumulated or at least presented himself as accumulating a lot of power in his hands. But at the same time, there's an elite there, and that elite is convinced that there is nothing good waiting for them in the event of a collapse of the regime or unification with Korea, with South Korea. They would be irrelevant or worse. So even if Kim Jong-un was not part of the equation, would the elite, you know, then come to the table or be more willing to work, you know, for a peaceful solution or towards more reforms? Maybe, but probably not. They have too much at stake in what this with this regime, and they're likely to go down with the ship. So it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense just to take out Kim Jong-un. You'd have to take out almost the entire elite. That's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, and if even a few remain, then the whole thing is still in place, the whole equation.
That's right. Yeah. So, okay, so what if you take out, what if you go after the missiles, the nuclear test sites, you know, the various, the artillery, batteries, everything that North Korea has that could threaten the rest of the neighbors or the world? Well, certainly the U.S. has planes, it has technology, but the North Koreans have been very good at playing this game of hide-and-go-seek with their strike-back capabilities for a long time. A lot of these facilities are deep in the ground, and I know we just tested our, you know, one of our fabulous new bombs in Afghanistan, and I have no doubt that part of that was to demonstrate to the Koreans that we have, you know, this giant bomb. But even if that we were to get 80%, that's still 20%, and there's no guarantee that, in fact, it's almost a certainty that the response by the North Koreans would be right out of the Wild Bunch and the Battle of Bloody Porch. And Seoul, Japan, shit, Beijing, we're not totally out of range here, but just about anybody, it's just going to be fire everything.
Yeah.
And that would be, you know, obviously enormous disaster all
around. At that point, they're like a dog that's stuck in the corner, and they're fearing for their life, rightfully so, and they're going to attack with all they can.
Yeah, and the need to retaliate would be overwhelming. All right, so if that doesn't work, what about, you know, if we're going to have that anyway, why don't we just go in and invade it? And again, the U.S., obviously the military capacity of the U.S. far, far, far exceeds anything the North Koreans have in terms of technology, but it is a mountainous country with a population that has been told from birth to expect this very eventuality. And it would be an enormously costly war on both sides. I mean, you would probably be talking casualties, civilian casualties, possibly going into the millions. I mean, certainly in the hundreds of thousands. And the casualties on the U.S. side, or the side of the whatever force that goes in, will be higher than anything the U.S. has seen in a generation or many generations. And, you know, for all the great spirit of our American men and women in uniform, the idea of a campaign where several thousand of them would be coming home in a box on day one, I just don't know if the U.S. electorate, for all of their go Trump, you know, frenzy, Toby Keith, red, white, and blue, I don't think people are ready for that reality.
Yeah, I don't think we could stomach it.
And I think the Koreans are counting on that.
Yeah.
And so, okay, there are your three options. None of them are particularly, not even not particularly good. They're all shades of horrible. So at this point, you're out of options.
Well, really? What about diplomacy, though?
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, this is where I might suggest that I know this is a controversial approach, but I think going back to the Sunshine Policy makes sense. I think that getting China and even South Korea involved, not to pressure the North, but to go back to an approach of, and I know this sounds counterproductive, but investment, trying to open up the economy, allowing more trade and contact, whether it's a seaport, special economic zone, hell, even a casino. Those, in the short term, yes, it will certainly prop up the regime because it will give an infusion of cash. I think in the long term, it will undermine what the Korean regime wants to do. The North Korean government relies on the relative, I do emphasize relative because people are far more aware of the outside world than I think a lot of people believe, but on the relative isolation of its population. And I think that the more contact, again, it's going back to the point we made with travel, the more contact they have with the outside world, the harder it is going to be to maintain that. And we saw that in China. I mean, not to say that China has democratized or become this glorious, you know, zone of freedom and harmony, but it certainly is a lot more open place now than it was in 1979.
Yeah, and arguably so, yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the government had to respond to people who were taken out of, who are no longer isolated or well aware of the world and where they are, where they are in it. And the government's had to respond to that. The North Korean government's never had to.
So maybe the ideal case is we do something like what you said, and 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, they start softening a little bit. The North Korean government does. The people become slightly more able to travel, and it opens up more like China did.
That's the goal. I mean, you can criticize this, and I'm sure people will, as being kind of a pipe dream. I mean, but I think it is the least bad of the possible alternatives we have.
But the only question that remains, though, is what happens when, or if or when, they actually are able to acquire a nuclear weapon on an ICBM?
Well, I mean, you know, they wouldn't be the first country to get one. And, you know, I think, you know, I wish I had a good answer for that. I mean, because, as I said, this the idea of opening is the least bad of all the options because it does allow for this. But maybe one of the things that you can do is, in exchange for this new era of investment and opening, if the stick doesn't work, bring out the carrot. Here's the challenge with all of this, though. The Pyongyang doesn't trust anyone involved. They certainly don't trust the United States. But I also think that there is some real fear in Pyongyang. If we bring China into play, because China would have to obviously be a big part of this, either as an investment partner or as a conduit for this. I mean, granted, they still control most of the trade. But I think there is some real concern in Pyongyang about Beijing, in that while Beijing is certainly committed to a continuing North Korean, a viable North Korean state for the foreseeable future, and is generally opposed to a reunification on the South's terms, I think there are people in Pyongyang who fear, and probably not without reason, that Beijing's commitment to a viable North Korean state does not necessarily equate to a commitment to the Kim family running it.
Yeah.
And I think with the, you know, the Malaysian facial that they gave, that was given to Kim Jong-nam, the brother, you know, he was China's pet Kim. And there was always this thought that if some regime change was necessary, they'd bring this guy out of China.
Yeah, do the old switcheroo, and now you've got a puppet.
Wouldn't be the first time China had played this game in the last 2,000 years with one of its neighbors. So, you know, with the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, I mean, this is where the shit gets medieval, because he's under the protection of China, and now they've, you know, assassinated him, and now China takes this as an affront. And I think, you know, there are probably many people in the government that, if they don't want to see North Korea go away, would really like to see Kim Jong-un go away. And so what that means is that, unfortunately, it reduces China's ability to make kind of meaningful approaches to Pyongyang, because at the end of the day, they don't like him and he knows it. And so, you know, I don't think there's a lot of trust there anymore.
Yeah, it's a scary, scary time that we're going through. And man, I wasn't so worried being in Beijing until you started talking about, well, we are within range.
Well, there's been reports periodically over the last 2 weeks of Beijing sending, you know, not just a few, but as many as 150,000 troops into the border regions up by the Yalu River. There was a post that was circulating on Twitter that was reportedly taken, a photo that was taken in the area around, I believe, Dandong, which is on the border there. The Chinese government asking Korean speakers to register in an event that they are needed as translators for a national level event.
Right.
And, you know, there's some clear concern that something is about to happen. There, this yesterday, and we're I guess we should mention that we're taping this on April 27th, but the day yesterday, the U.S. House and Senate were brought into special session, and they were apparently briefed on North Korea, although many of the participants in the briefing said it really wasn't anything new, but that's a significant step. And so, you know, the pieces are moving in place where the possibility of rapid escalation exists.
Yeah, I think our best hope at this point is that Xi Jinping talks some sense into Donald Trump. I think at least got him to understand what the situation is.
Let's just pause for a moment that Xi Jinping is the voice of reason and stability and globalization in East Asia, and the fate of European liberalism rests in an East German politician. Angela Merkel. So, I mean, if this is the world we live in today, this is the universe having some fun with us.
It has felt like that the last few months, and I'm not even in the United States.
Exactly.
I haven't even been there since the election.
I made the mistake of posting something about Trump on my Facebook page. It was a picture of Donald Trump posing with Sarah Palin and Ted Nugent and Kid Rock and their various paramours. And all I could put on it was just, could someone please go back to 2008 and explain the photo to anyone at that time? You know, I mean, you really wouldn't be able to. It is a very surreal world that we are living in. But unfortunately, the problems that we have are very real. And they're the problems that, frankly, more experienced and thoughtful administrations have had to deal with and have dealt with unsuccessfully. I have grave concerns that the current circus that is the American executive branch is equipped in any way to deal with a crisis on the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, I don't want to sound alarmist, but I will, because it basically scares the shit out of me. You know, what the possibility, again, of rapid escalation on the Korean Peninsula, it's one of the two or three most dangerous places in the world. And, you know, the idea that we may come to a situation where we're sending boots into Korea and Seoul comes under fire, I just think it would be such a tragic miscalculation of the situation. But it feels that there are people for whom that is a win. And we'll have to see.
Oh, that's a fair point, too. Or a scary point. Yeah, I guess I can leave it at this, though. Like, part of what I gain in my own knowledge whenever I travel is just a little bit of understanding of the culture and of the people. And understand that people are people, like, no matter where you go. And, okay, some of the stuff I saw in North Korea maybe was a show. A few things were. I think most of it was pretty real. Life was pretty much going on. I'm not saying that I saw a microcosm of the country. I mean, I only did see mostly just Pyongyang, where the wealthiest and most elite people are.
Yeah, you get the feeling Pyongyang's the reward, right? Like, if you do good, you get to live in Pyongyang.
Yeah. That's maybe, I don't know, 5%, I think, of the country or something like that lives there. So I saw that. But I will say, the people are, they're human beings. They're families. They're raising their kids. You know, they want the same stuff that we want in many cases. And yeah, they were born under a dictatorship and essentially live in a cult. That's through no fault of their own. And it would be absolutely tragic if hundreds of thousands of them were killed in a war.
Yeah, I mean, it would be the bloodiest conflict that the U.S. has fought against in many generations. And, you know, I just don't know if the cost is worth what would be gained. And even if there's there are smarter people than I who are been working on this for years, and they haven't come up with any good solution either. But I think to a person, people who do study this will tell you that the military option really is not, as we kind of went through the scenarios, I mean, those are not feasible approaches. And, you know, if the idea is for a war, and that, you know, there are some kind of weird conspiracy theories that some of the people in the White House, like Steve Bannon, who seems to be on the way out, is actually kind of pushing for a war as a sort of cleansing exercise for the world. I mean, you know, God help us all.
Yeah, scary thought indeed. We should move on to some other lighter subject. Why don't we talk about your own podcast that you have?
Sure. You know, for over 10 years, I've run a website in Beijing called Jottings from the Granite Studio. It rather started, like a lot of these websites, as a bit of a blog. Over the years, though, as I do most of my writing now for other publications, it's become a little bit more of a curated space for stuff that I've done in a lot of other, again, like other magazines or both in China and overseas. Part of that last fall, we put together a short series of podcasts called Barbarians at the Gate. And we, by we, I mean myself and James Palmer, who's a writer and historian here in Beijing. He is now the Asia editor at Foreign Policy. We put together the first series last fall. We talked to David Moser on Chinese language. We talked to Alec Ash about his book Wish Lanterns and youth culture in China. And then we also did a couple of short episodes on some of our, you know, favorite conquerors, conquest dynasties, and general Central Asians run amok among Chinese history. We're going to begin season two or series two, starting. We'll be taping the first episode this week. I'll be going up probably just after the May holiday. We'll run the second series probably through the summer. Take a short break and then come back for a third series sometime later in the year.
Oh, sounds great. I've listened to all of them and they...
Well, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun.
It is. I think one of the challenges with a podcast is always, especially if you do it as a kind of partnership, is being able to find time in everyone's schedule.
Sure.
So to sit down at the table to put it together. So we may incorporate more kind of solo releases for the second and third series, just so we can keep a fairly consistent stream of episodes, even at times when, you know, if I'm traveling, especially in places like Pyongyang where it's hard to do a podcast, or James is busy with writing and editing, we can still kind of keep the episodes going.
Yeah, sounds good. I'm sure you're more than capable.
I'm looking forward to it. We've got some good topics lined up for this upcoming series, and I'm looking forward to exploring them.
Cool. Are you still planning to mix like history, some of these colorful characters in the last couple thousand years, with like more modern stuff?
Yeah, I think that's kind of our approach. You know, there are some great podcasts that are just straight history. You know, Laszlo Montgomery does the China History podcast. It's
all
absolutely
right.
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know, he does kind of one dynasty after another. It's a wonderful kind of straight narrative. If you're looking for like a, you know, kind of living textbook for Chinese history, could not go wrong with Laszlo's podcast. There are other podcasts that kind of focus more narrowly on some aspects of Chinese history. There's a wonderful podcast out right now going through the book or the novel, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a really excellent podcast. I think, you know, one of the things that we want to do, and that has always interested me, you know, even when I was just a blogger, was not writing just history, but, you know, the tagline of the blog way, way, way back was, you know, a Qing historian reads the newspaper. And the idea was to filter what was going on today through the lens of the recent and sometimes not so recent past. And so I think that's an approach that we're going to continue to take. And I also think, too, that the tone of the podcast, not unlike the tone I'll often take in either walks or when I do lectures or talks and workshops or class, making it slightly more irreverent towards the subjects that we're talking about. You know, for example, you know, it's one thing to solemnly talk about how, you know, Dr. Sun Yat-sen was the father of modern China and the father of the nation, you know, for his part in the 1911 revolution that ultimately led to the end of the Qing dynasty. But I think it's more interesting to talk about, you know, how does he rank in the historical pantheon of all-time great bullshit artists? You know, he's up there. Yeah. You know, you put Benjamin Franklin in that elite category, but, you know, Sun Yat-sen was a horrible revolutionary. I mean, he was just terrible, a man of action, but the man could talk a Mary Knoll nun out of her pants. And, you know, sometimes in a revolution, that's what you need. So, you know, kind of put, you know, try to look at some of these subjects, but from a slightly different, you know, perspective. And, you know, I think that would be, that's always a lot more fun.
Yeah, I think it's that kind of thing especially helps me as a foreigner, because I came here really not knowing much about China, and there's so much that I saw at first that I'm like, what the hell? Why did they do it this way? This is so weird. And with a little bit of historical context, I think it kind of can really help to understand the culture so much better. I liked especially how you guys compared the different generations of youth that have popped up over the last century and compare and contrast what happened with them.
I think that was an interesting one too, because that was really talking to me about recent history. That was the interview that we did with the author Alec Ash, and Alec, of course, his book Wish Lanterns was a look at several of China's young generation, and we took this sort of what his research and his conclusions about China's youth culture today, and talked about explored how that kind of, as you said, matched up against the generation of the past, whether it's the 80s generation that was in Tiananmen Square, or the Cultural Revolution generation, or taking even further back, you know, the generation of the May 4th era that culminated in the 1919 demonstrations. You know, what does China's youth look like, you know, when you look through that kind of lens? And I thought that was a fun thing to do, especially because Alec had done so much research and had thought about these issues extensively in the preparation for his book.
Cool, sounds great, and I look forward to hearing more from you in the future. Sure. There's one more thing that's been on my mind lately.
Okay.
And that's this bicycle situation in Beijing with the rental bikes. The
swipe and go.
Yeah, do you have any, I should explain what these are. There's been this concept of renting a bike from a docking station for a while. I mean, we used to have them, still have them in Madison, Wisconsin, where I used to live. You go up to the docking station, you take a bike, pedal it around for a while, and then you take it back to the same place or a different place. Mm-hmm. And it's a great way to get around as long as you happen to be near a docking station. But what they've done in China, and I think it's throughout the country, just in the last 6 months, someone came up with the idea of, well, why don't we just allow people to leave their bikes anywhere? And it just locks, the wheel locks to the frame. And it sounded like an awesome idea. So people started, they use an app to find out where the closest bike is, and scan a QR code on the bike, the lock opens, you ride around for however long you want, you pay really very little money, maybe pay like 2 kwai an hour. It's almost free. And you just leave it wherever you want.
I think that was the big selling point for most people, because the docking stations, people didn't really, I mean, the original bike, like the docking station scheme they had here, which was run by the Beijing municipal government, not only had to park it at a docking station, but even to get into the program, you had to go find the office, fill out 19 forms and a blood sample and right, all kinds of stuff. These, you kind of, you know, you scan, you download the app, you put in some information, you scan your passport, and then you pay a deposit, although that's been a kind of an issue. And then you're ready to go. Yeah, I mean, first of all, anything that gets people out of cars and onto bicycles, I am all for that. You know, as a fairly committed pedestrian, you know, the name of my company is Beijing by Foot. I am a fairly staunch enemy of the internal combustion engine, particularly when it's barreling down at me on the sidewalk of somewhere I'm walking.
Yes.
So anything that gets people out of cars, that's awesome. And I love them because they, for me, they replace the bus in the sense that when you, it's the last kilometer. You take the subway somewhere, get out of the subway, and you're like just far enough where you don't want to walk, but not far enough that you, you know, it necessitates like a taxi or a bus.
Yeah, I should emphasize, these are not like awesome road bikes or anything. You're not going to want to bike like 50 miles on these things.
No, they're also pretty small. So I look like a circus bear riding around on these things. But the point is, you can leave them anywhere. That's what people love about them. But that's also one of the two biggest problems people have with them, because people do leave them anywhere. You know, middle of the road, middle of the sidewalk, middle of the street. So the, you know, the, as the number of companies involved in this have proliferated, and I understand, like, one of the original companies, Mobike, I understand they're and I'm sure someone knows more than about me, more about this than I do, but they're on like their third round of funding already.
So they're burning through cash.
Yeah, and then there's many competitors out there now. So as these things are proliferated and people are starting to complain because they block sidewalks, the government just this week has promulgated some guidelines, and they're not outside the realm of reason. One of them is that the bikes need to have GPS, and that the government suggested that there should be some mechanism in the bike such that you can't lock it if it's within certain zones.
Oh,
so you can't just park the thing in the middle of Tiananmen Square.
Sure.
Yeah, tanks are okay, rideshare bikes not. But the other one is the deposits. A lot of people have complained that these companies are not great about giving back the deposits. There's some thought that actually there's a certain pyramid scheme thing going on here. The new deposits are paying for the services, they're subsidizing the services, existing customers. So I understand that one of the other guidelines or suggestions is that the companies are now gonna have to put deposits in a separate account independent of their operating budget.
Oh, so they never run out of money then.
Right, so the idea is otherwise what you do is you just have to sign up more customers to pay for to subsidize the services you're giving your other customers, but eventually that's gonna all crash.
Yeah, you'd have like a bank run kind of situation.
That's exactly what they're worried about.
Yeah.
So anyway, there are some things happening that make a lot of sense. You know, I was an early adopter of these. I think it's a great idea and concept. I think like a lot of things that the execution has been a little bit haphazard and rushed. My biggest feeling though is that it's due for more than just a subtle set of guidelines. I think what's happening now is there are fault lines being drawn on the streets of Beijing because the automotively inclined. You know, the drivers with their huge SUV Mienza mobiles, to use the Chinese word for face, are, you know, getting tired of having to, you know, wait or not being able to park on the sidewalk because bikes are parked there. People are in the bike lane, so how are you going to be able to pass people on the road if you can't zip down a bike lane at 90 miles an hour? You know, these narrow hutongs are, you know, people are just delicately or politely riding a bike down them. So, I mean, how are you going to go, you know, it's really embarrassing with your giant SUV and your 16-year-old, quote-unquote, niece in the driver's seat. You know, officials embarrassed because he has to wait for some guy on a bicycle. I mean, what's the point of being an official if you can't run the guy off the road? So, you know, once that class kind of starts getting annoyed at all the bicyclists, I think we're going to see a big crackdown.
Okay.
And, you know, at the end of the day, it's the SUV cadre class here that ultimately calls the shots. And once they're inconvenienced, that's when things start
to
happen.
Yeah. Yes. If it's interesting, if nothing else, being here. It's just, I've been here almost 3 years, and it's just so many fascinating things have happened. But this is one of them. 6 months ago, these things didn't exist. Then 3 months ago, there was like, oh, wow, this is a great idea. And then a couple months ago, it's like, wait a minute, now there's like five of these companies.
It's like mushrooms after a rain. Like, they're everywhere.
Yeah, and then within the last month, you can't even, I can't even bike down the bike lanes anymore. I'm like the SUV people, because I ride a road bike, and it's fast. And the people who are riding these mobikes, a lot of them, they've never ridden a bike before.
That is absolutely true. I that's a very good point, because that's true. They see them on these bikes, and yeah, they haven't done it in years. I will say one thing about these. I understand that in the U.S., and you've never had an idea, a lot of these bike share programs come with a helmet.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen
and
it.
And in some cities, I did some graduate school at UC Davis, and Davis is a city in California that's known for its bicycles. They're very militant, the police are, about always wearing a helmet. Huh. Well, it's Beijing. I mean, nobody wears a helmet. It's a mass effort to prove Darwin was wrong. And so I am very concerned. You know, I got into a small discussion with the missus over this when she was riding back on the mobike, and I said, you really ought to get a helmet because you're riding this rather unwieldy bicycle back, you know, down the streets where it's getting dark at rush hour, and it's just not safe. And that hasn't even been addressed, although I'm waiting, you know, very nervously, just like you do the day after the 4th of July for the inevitable, who lost the finger.
Right.
I'm waiting for the big accident to happen. I hope it doesn't, but I think it's going to this summer. There's going to be some accident, some kid's going to get killed. Car versus bicycle, someone flips over, you know, it's so easy, someone flips over the hood, head lands head first, and that's the ball game. And no one wears helmets here. No one.
No. I'm thinking back in Wisconsin, I think the whole state, there's no helmet law for bikes or motorcycles. And I think the rental bikes from the docks, I don't remember.
God bless being the home of Harley Davidson, huh?
Yeah, that's right. You know what's weird? It's this weird tangent. I think motorcycles, actually, if you're under 18, you have to wear a helmet, but not if you're over. So the idea is, well, you're an adult, you're only risking your own life. You know, if you don't care about your own head, then it's not the government's job to regulate it.
I grew up in New Hampshire. I mean, seriously, speaking of Darwin, our state seal is like three guys without their seatbelts, carrying a Bud Light, without wearing a helmet on a motorcycle, giving a finger to like origin of the species. So, I mean, I totally get this.
Yeah. Well, but then speaking of the seatbelts, that's the other side of it. When it comes to seatbelts, the Wisconsin government at least is like, well, you must wear your seatbelt, and it's our job to enforce this, and we can pull you over now if you're not wearing a seatbelt, and we have to protect you. Like, wait, guys, both of those sides have like legitimate arguments to them. But it's all or none. Like, you can't have one policy and like hands off, laissez faire, and then the other hand, like other policy, different policy of big government. I mean, come on.
It's good training to live in Beijing.
I guess the gray area kind of thing. Yeah.
I think the safety thing is hysterical. I mean, the number of times I've had parents like throw themselves over their children to protect them from my little 10-inch tall dog that I walk in the morning. And then they, because it's a huge threat to public safety. And then when they get outside, they take the said child and plunk them on the handlebars without a helmet of a bicycle that they've just rented, and then plow out into traffic. And I'm like, I understand the protective spirit of Mama Bear against the dire wolf, even though the dire wolf, you know, doesn't even know its tail is attached to it.
The dire poodle,
exactly. But if we're going to do safety, you know, you might want to go all the way. Far be from me tell you how to raise the one child, but you only really have one of those at this point. So, policy just got changed last year. So you want to protect this one, and riding out into traffic without a helmet, not the way to do that.
Right. I mean, I've got this theory, or at least had a theory when I first moved here, that's maybe evolving, that people tend to think anything that's actually very dangerous is perfectly safe, and then anything that's perfectly safe is actually very dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, riding a scooter at night without a helmet, not a problem. Drinking cold water, that'll kill you.
Yeah, that'll do you. Yeah. You don't, or damage your uterus if you're a female.
Well, we'll see what happens with the bike share. I think it's a wonderful idea in concept. I do think it needs the certain tweaks. I think some of the rules that the government has issued so far make a lot of sense. I think that'll help a lot. But I am a little bit worried, as I said, when the automotive class finally loses its patience, and we may see a big crackdown. That also could have some interesting business implications if these companies are getting so much investment, but also holding these deposits. And if the market bottoms out, what's going to happen?
Yeah, no more money. Yeah, it's so. I think a little bit of extra regulation at this point would be a good thing, but I don't want to see those bikes go away either. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
All right, well, Jeremiah, it's been an awesome discussion. So
yeah, thanks
for coming on the show.
I really appreciate it. And anytime.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Jeremiah Jenny for coming on the show. I'm going to put up a link to Jeremiah's blog and to his podcast and his walking tours company on my website, which is 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number, 1000daysbetween.com. If you enjoyed this episode, as always, I'd really appreciate it if you'd tell a friend about it and leave me a review on iTunes. Again, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.